Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's a thing that's always bugged me. How some economic numbers do you absolutely no good. What are called lagging indicators. Statistics that tell you what the economy was doing a month ago or the quarter just ended. Kind of like driving down the highway with your eyes on the rearview mirror, if you ask me. And now to top it all off, you've got economists trying to make sense of it. Welcome to the April Unemployment Report, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday. Today, May the 4th. Glad to have you with us. So what are you supposed to do with today's jobs report if you're Ben Bernanke, or anybody else for that matter? The Labor Department reported unemployment in April ticked up a tenth to 4.5%. And at the same time, the number of new jobs created last month grew at the slowest rate in more than 2 years. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler tried to figure it out.
Last month, companies added 88,000 jobs to their payrolls.
That's well below recent trends, and it's well below where we need to be to keep the unemployment rate from rising.
That's Jared Bernstein, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute.
The slowing we've observed in the overall economy is finally catching up to the labor market.
If the modest job growth continues, he says we're likely to see a gradual increase in unemployment and a decrease in consumer spending. But other analysts are more optimistic. Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial. While she does anticipate slightly higher unemployment ahead, Swonk also sees some positive signs. She says manufacturing jobs are picking up and expects automobile production will kick into gear in the second quarter.
So we're seeing some bright spots come to light even as the economy comes out of its darkest hours.
What does this all mean for the Federal Reserve, which meets next week? Swonk says the jobs report shows little sign of inflation, so she anticipates the Fed will leave interest rates unchanged. But looking further ahead, economist Jared Bernstein expects increased unemployment in the months ahead will eventually prompt the Fed to cut interest rates. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
What a week it's been for the business of business news. We learned Monday the Australian press baron Rupert Murdoch wants to buy Dow Jones. That's the parent of the Wall Street Journal. Murdoch's willing to pay a pretty penny for it, too, $5 billion, which has so far been greeted with a collective yawn from the family that controls Dow Jones. And today, the news and financial information service Reuters, of which we're a client, confirmed it's the subject of a takeover bid. The Canadian data broker Thomson's the suitor there. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains why news is so hot right now.
Newspapers have been taking a beating, but Andrew Schwartzman of the Media Access Project says news itself has never been more in demand.
The news business is not faltering. The news business is exploding.
In this age of electronic trading and split-second decisions, that's particularly true of financial news services like Reuters. Joe Strupp is with the Media Trade, editor and publisher.
Through the web and through the globalization of economic news and economic dealings, there's more of that kind of coverage being sought.
Which is what makes Dow Jones and its Wall Street Journal so alluring to Rupert Murdoch, a man who's also planning to launch his very own business news channel. Some Dow Jones employees doubt whether Murdoch will be as good for them as he believes they would be for him, but he's trying to persuade them. Steve Yount is with the union that represents Wall Street Journal employees.
He said, you know, I really like this newspaper. The stories are too long, and I can't finish them all. And I'd like to change this, and I'd like to change that. In other words, he doesn't like the newspaper.
Yount says he's worried that all Murdoch really wants is the famous Dow Jones brands. Most people who analyze the media say that at its core, the brands are what makes the property worth the $5 billion Murdoch is offering. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
The Brazilian government's been in negotiations with the U.S. drug maker Merck over cheaper AIDS drugs, specifically an antiretroviral called efavirenz. Talks haven't been going so well, so today Brazil's president Lula da Silva took matters into his own hands. He signed something called a compulsory license. It lets Brazilian companies break Merck's patents, manufacture the drug themselves, and then sell it for far, far less than the brand name pill. It's the second time this year Merck's been on the receiving end of a compulsory license, so we asked Helen Palmer at the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH to check out the medical patent trade.
Brazil made its decision after failing to persuade Merck to cut the price per pill of efavirenz by more than half. Harvard economist Frederick Shearer says Brazil's move is perfectly legal under international trade rules.
When those negotiations have failed to yield a satisfactory conclusion, then the recipient nation has the right to issue a compulsory license.
About 75,000 Brazilians take efavirenz. If Brazil did produce a generic version, Merck would lose about $250 million over 5 years. But analyst Mark Rivera of Strategic Pharma Consultants says lost revenue is not the main danger here.
The biggest risk comes more from the overall precedent that this may be setting for Brazil and other developing markets.
Brazil's used the threat of compulsory licensing before to get a good price deal on drugs. And when Thailand signed a compulsory license for efavirenz in January, Merck slashed the price to 65 cents a pill, the deal Brazil wants. So this may not be the end of the story. Mark Weinstein of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation says this drug's been around for 8 years, and Merck's just trying to squeeze more cash out.
This is gravy for the drug companies. You know, it's all going to drop to their bottom line.
Weinstein says Merck and the drug companies trying to protect their markets are on the wrong side of history. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Investors broke fast out of the gate this morning. They faded by the final turn, but managed to finish in the money. Kentucky Derby's this weekend, you know. We'll have the details in a chat about the week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. What have we learned so far from the UN's International Panel on Climate Change? From its first report in February, we learned that human activity is almost certainly responsible for global warming. From its second report a month ago, that the consequences of climate change are really, really bad. And from its third report out today, that it might not cost as much as we thought to do something about it. Nancy Marshall-Genzer is following the story for us from Washington. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, Kai.
Nancy, you read the papers this morning. It says things like taking care of global warming is now seen to be affordable and manageable. What's the actual cost? What are people saying?
Well, the least stringent recommendation in the report would shave about a tenth of a percent off of global gross domestic product every year. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but the head of the White House Council on Environmental Quality said it would cause a global recession. And basically, the Bush administration is saying, look, we know that we are the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, but it's going to take us longer to reduce our emissions. You got to give us a break here.
No pressure, but, you know, economists have a tough time figuring out what the jobs number is going to be from month to month in this country. How are we expected to know what the global economy is going to be by the year 2030?
Kai, you don't want to bet the ranch on these numbers. One economist I talked to today, Ray Kopp, said, look, we can predict 5 to 10 years into the future, but after that, it's very difficult.
But when you start getting out 30 and 40 and 50 years, I mean, you can imagine how difficult it is to know what the world is going to look like and then what a regulatory policy is going to cost.
The comeback, of course, to how much it might cost to take care of global warming is to think about the cost of doing nothing.
Exactly. And the British government actually came out with a report last year saying if we do nothing about global warming, it would cost 5 to 20% of GDP every year. And then there are also costs like drought and flooding that could lead to big migrations of people. I talked to Joseph Rahm about that today. He's a former Clinton administration Energy Department official.
I mean, what is the cost of, you know, 20 to 80 foot sea level rise? And what is the cost of increasing desertification and making water scarcity a problem for a billion people?
Nancy, there was mention in the report this morning of the importance of moving away from carbon and carbon dioxide producing technologies. What did it say about what technologies we ought to go to and how we might encourage other countries to use those technologies?
Well, that's a tricky question. It talked about solar energy, energy from wind, not so much about nuclear. There's also the technology of taking carbon dioxide emissions and injecting them into the ground. But, you know, getting back to China, China says, hey, guys, we're way behind the rest of you. If you expect us to cut our emissions, you got to share that technology with us. And China doesn't have such a great track record on protecting intellectual property. So the U.S. isn't too enthusiastic about that.
So do you think that might make it less likely that other countries would sign on to this agreement?
I do. And actually, this agreement, it's really just a series of recommendations. It's nothing enforceable, but it could be used to negotiate the next round in Kyoto.
All right, Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
Of course, environmentalists, policy wonks, and energy firms from fossil fuel to nuclear will be poring over that report Nancy and I were just talking about. You know, they're not exactly renewable, but nuclear plants do make enormous amounts of power on very little fuel, and no CO2 either. But there is that little radioactive storage problem. Jeff Broomfield reports.
At one of the biggest nuclear power plants in the country, Peach Bottom in Delta, Pennsylvania, turbines spin 24/7, producing enough power for about 2 million homes. Past heavy doors and radiation detectors is something that looks a lot like your swimming pool. Well, except for the 3,000 old nuclear fuel rods sitting at the bottom. Plant manager Mike Mazzara.
Some of this fuel could be original fuel from our first operating cycle, which would be 1973, 1974 timeframe.
That's one of the catches with nuclear power. Fuel rods have been piling up at the plants for decades with nowhere to go. The government-designated site at Yucca Mountain, Nevada was supposed to open in 1998. But technical snags, lawsuits, and politics have kept that from happening. At Peach Bottom, it's gotten so bad they've started storing waste out back in concrete casks.
The industry is very frustrated.
Stephen Kraft works at the Nuclear Energy Institute, the main nuclear lobby in Washington.
We are in the business of making electricity and not in the business of storing spent fuel.
So the Energy Department is proposing something else, recycling. Well, that's what they'd call it if they were trash collectors, but they're nuclear engineers, so they call it reprocessing. Adam Levine is spent fuel chief at Exelon, the company that manages Peach Bottom. He says that by dissolving the old fuel in acid and extracting unused isotopes,
there's an opportunity to use more than 90% of the weight in new fuel.
A few other countries like France already reprocess, and now the White House wants to create a global recycling network. We'll sell fresh fuel to smaller countries and then buy it back for reuse in our own reactors. The investment community likes the idea, but it doesn't come cheap. The U.S. would need to spend billions on a full-scale facility. Next year, the Energy Department wants to spend $400 million just for R&D.
The proposal is a huge, unaffordable excursion into nuclear state socialism on a global scale.
Chris Payne is with the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group. He says that reprocessing just doesn't make economic sense.
All the calculations show that recycled fuel is more costly than the most pessimistic predictions for the future of conventional nuclear fuel.
And there's another problem. The U.S. reprocessed fuel decades ago, but we didn't use it for electricity. Again, Chris Payne.
This is the process that was used to separate material for U.S. nuclear weapons.
The administration is proposing a way to make it harder to create bombs with the old fuel, but many in Congress are still skeptical about the plan and the example it sets, especially at a time when North Korea and Iran are pursuing weapons technology. So for now, the fuel will likely stay put. And in the meantime, Exelon says it's going to cost about $500 million over the next decade to store waste at Peach Bottom and its 16 other plants. In Washington, I'm Jeff Brumfield for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with our stockbroker business analyst friend David Johnson down in Dallas. How are you?
I'm great. Did I ever mention to you that May was, I think, my favorite month for the stock market?
Yes, you did. And more importantly, you're still there, dude, even after you told me you were leaving.
Well, it's early in May, you know. It's only May the 4th.
Well, that's true.
Heck, you know, this is sort of a long goodbye. Besides, it would be a shame to walk away from this market.
Yeah.
It keeps, you know, looking beyond bad news, it keeps looking for excuses to go up. I mean, you look this morning,
right.
You could spin those numbers this morning any way you wanted to spin. You could take a look at that and say, look, the job numbers were revised downwards for the last 2 months. And these numbers, 88,000, come on, that's anemic. How many millions of people we got in the United States? You only create 88,000 jobs. Market didn't look at that.
Why not? Why didn't the market look at that?
Because it's a bull market.
Ah.
And I know it sounds simplistic, but I'm telling you, how many times have we used the argument on the other side in a bear market and you have obvious good news and the market just looks the other way and keeps on selling and it's momentum. Yesterday was a great example. Finally, you had a major house, UBS, come out and say, you know, we had all these losses in this hedge fund and we're just going to liquidate it. And we're going to take a $300 million loss on it. And here's a street that's been worrying about, you know, some big scandal, something that's going to come over the horizon and undo the market. And that happened to us back, you remember, 98, I guess it was.
Yeah, 98 with long-term capital, right. Now, I mean, we need to delve in a little bit here because you're of mixed minds about hedge funds, aren't you?
Yeah, I really, it's a love-hate relationship. I mean, on the one hand, I really hate anything that I can't get out of on a moment's notice. That's the one thing I love about the stock market. You may not like the price, but by golly, you don't have to go to bed with it. It can be gone before the day's end. You just sell it. Liquidity, that's a good thing about it. The other side is I know what I've got. You know, if I have a money manager, or if I got a mutual fund or whatever, I know what's in there. And in a hedge fund, it's just a black box. I mean, they won't tell you what's in there. And they take your money, they take 20% of the profits, and then a 2% management fee just to really make you angry.
And yet somehow UBS managed to lose, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, I know. Well, see, and then there's the love side.
Yeah.
The love side is they buy stuff that nobody else will buy. They provide liquidity. It's just like if you were going to sell your house and you put your house on the market and your neighbor does and the people down the street suddenly and everybody else, and all of a sudden there's a glut of houses on the market. Well, along would come a hedge fund and package all these things together, buy all of them at one time and go sell them off to some other schmo.
Because that's always what you're looking for in the market, some other
schmo.
Yeah,
but the market didn't even look at that. This is a nice market.
All right. The beauty of the markets with David Johnson. Thank you, David. Coming up, taking the state goods private.
I think it's a step to make Sweden more normal like other countries. And we believe that the state should decrease its ownership. Absolutely.
Pay attention to that absolutely thing. It's going to be important. But first, let's do the numbers. Takeover activity fueled the markets today. The Dow Industrials rose 23 points, a tenth of 1%, to close at 13,264. The NASDAQ climbed 6 points, a quarter of 1%, to end at 2572. The S&P 500 added 3 points, two-tenths percent, finished at 1505. For the week, the Dow up 1.1%. The NASDAQ gained 0.5%. The S&P 500 climbed about 0.75%. Newspaper reports that Microsoft has talked informally with Yahoo about a possible takeover bid goosed the markets today. Microsoft sagged 1.33%. Yahoo, though, powered up 10%. Reuters rocketed up about 27% on the U.S. market on its takeover rumors. Thomson, the potential buyer in that instance, fell 0.6%. Bond prices rose. That means the yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note fell to 4.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for March. President Bush hosts Queen Elizabeth II at the White House. And thousands of naked people are expected in Mexico City's Zocalo Square. American photographer Spencer Tunick hopes this shoot will be bigger than his Barcelona shoot, where 7,000 volunteer models participated. This time he has room for about 85,000. Say cheese. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The World Health Organization said today it's going to provide online one-stop shopping for information on clinical drug trials. Doctors, researchers, and curious patients now have access to the results of 50,000 clinical trials in the U.S., Britain, and Australia. It's a big deal because as it stands now, a lot of drug research never finds its way to publication. The WHO says it's a significant proportion that doesn't get published. Commentator Michael Millinson says today's news is a good start at addressing the broad issue of healthcare quality, but just a start.
I was sitting in the doctor's lounge of a hospital one day, waiting to give one more talk on the broken healthcare system, when a thick report caught my eye. Opening it was like finding a secret message accidentally left out in plain sight. Inside, the report listed every cancer patient the hospital treated without their names, how serious their cancer was, and the initial outcome of treatment. This type of cancer registry, I soon learned, is available in every single state. Maybe I could make it public. Although cancer doctors work long hours, they still fail frequently to provide therapies the medical evidence says the patient needs. Sometimes the problem is occupational blinders. For instance, radiation oncologists think prostate cancer should be treated with radiation, while urological surgeons favor surgery. Sometimes it's communication. The doctor thought a treatment had been considered, but it hadn't. Sometimes it's human limitations. The doctor thought he was doing what's best, but his memory of the medical literature was flawed. What's scary is that getting treatment for any disease based on the medical evidence happens on average about 55% of the time. Essentially, you're flipping a coin. We waste 30 cents of every healthcare dollar providing treatments we don't need, not providing treatments we do, and fixing preventable medical mistakes. That adds up to a $700 billion problem. But perhaps the worst thing is this: the public can't see that cancer registry. By law, it's confidential. To really improve health care, we need reform that promotes real-time use of clinical evidence, like that registry. We need reform that promotes real-time use of clinical evidence. And we need reform that holds up a mirror to busy professionals and reminds them that how good you are doesn't say how good you can be.
Michael Millinson is a healthcare quality consultant and a visiting scholar at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. For more information about those drug trials, head to our website. It's marketplace.org. And if you're so inclined, drop us a line while you're there by clicking on the link that says contact. French beverage company Pernod Ricard sold a boatload of booze this quarter. Sales came in at almost $2 billion. That's everything from wine to whiskey, and if the company has its way, more vodka. During their earnings announcement this morning, executives reaffirmed their interest in buying Russia's Stolichnaya brand and Sweden's Absolut, which, along with some other state-owned Swedish companies, might be coming on the market sometime soon. From Stockholm, Klaus Andreasen reports.
It's Saturday afternoon and minutes before closing time at the Swedish alcohol retail monopoly Systembolaget. The checkout lines are long as people stock up for the weekend. This business will remain state-owned, but one popular product, Absolut Vodka, may soon have a new owner. Mats Odell, Christian Democrat and Minister of Financial Markets, is in charge of the privatization.
The Swedish state is by far the biggest owner of companies in Sweden, and we don't think that's a good way to create new opportunities.
Last year, Sweden's state-owned companies produced record results and added $5 billion to Sweden's bottom line. Since they are doing so well, selling them now seems like a bad idea, says Lotta Gröning, an editor at the social democrat daily Aftonbladet.
For years and years and years, they have given the state and the people a lot of good income that we need.
Absolut Vodka is made entirely in the small town of Åhus in the south of Sweden. Last year alone, 23 million gallons of vodka was made there, most of it sold to the United States. Jan Lundin chairs the local United Food and Commercial Workers Union. He told Swedish Public Radio Absolut would be a desirable acquisition for any potential purchaser.
Ja, om man då tar att det skulle bli en internationell köpare utav vin och sprit.
Of all our brands, Absolut is our flagship, and most likely the product an international buyer of the company would like to purchase. That's why I believe an international buyer may break up the company.
För en internationell köpare att hålla ihop det.
This is not the first time Sweden's state-owned companies are being sold. In the 1990s, when the Social Democrats were in power, shares in the telecommunication giant Telia were offered to the public. But with the huge number of shares suddenly appearing on the market, stock prices plummeted.
A lot of people who trust the Social Democratic Party, they took all their saved money and buy the shares. And then the shares, they went very bad, and many people lost a big deal of their money. So it didn't go so well.
With the Telia fiasco in mind, it's perhaps not surprising that only a third of the public favors the current sale. But financial analyst Ronald Fagerfjell believes the privatization will help the Swedish economy adjust to a global market.
We are heading in the right direction right now. We try to keep the welfare state, but we try to liberalize it. We try to let the entrepreneurs in the economy free. And I think the existing Swedish entrepreneurs have done a lot of good the last 10, 15 years. I could never dream of such a fantastic development that we had lately. So I feel very good about these things.
In the coming years, the Swedish government is looking at thinning its portfolio even further, Minister Mats Odell says. It's a necessary move towards creating a dynamic new Sweden.
I think it's a step to make Sweden more normal like other countries. And we believe that the state should decrease its ownership, absolutely.
Sweden's parliament is scheduled to debate the privatization bill in early June. From Stockholm, I'm Claes Andreasen for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, do you remember Pizza for Pesos? We told you back in January about a Texas-based pizza chain that had started accepting pesos as well as dollars. Pizza Patron was criticized at the time. The company even received some hate mail, but the move did bring them a larger slice of the market, a slice that's approximately 34% bigger than before. First quarter sales doubled at some stores, and the company's founder says the trial run is completely over. Pizza for Pesos is now permanent. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 23 points. That's a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq picked up 6 points, a quarter of 1%. The S&P 500 ticked up 3 points, two-tenths of 1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, putting innovation to work in Cambodia.
And we just base it back to basics. What can we buy? What's used locally here? What's the skill levels available? And that's what we come up with.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that on Monday.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.